Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We all create a story about ourselves. We come up with a concept of who we are. Then we build layers and layers and layers of that and a whole lot of neural pathways. And then that becomes our story. And then we start to live that life. And in living that life, we further confirm in our own brain that that's who we are. My story about myself was that I was a mortgage guy.
What if the writer is attempting to create a story where nothing much happens, where people don't change? More reflection of the real world.
Nothing happens in the world? Are you out of your fucking mind?
Welcome to A Theory of Mind, a podcast about brains, minds, and the lived-in experience of change. I'm your host, author and biographer Ben McKelvey, and each week we interview someone about their brain and their life, and in most instances those brains and lives will be atypical. This week, that brain and that life will be of Mark Burris, business icon, business mentor, boxer, farmer, author, and also the host of the Australian version of The Apprentice. Mark is a unique guy. He's been on the BRW Rich List multiple times. He holds two honorary doctorates, and he's also been awarded the Order of Australia. Most interesting to this show, though, is that he has this sort of psychological atypicality that's likely helped him become very rich and very esteemed, the man that he is. But it's also put him into some mental backroads that could lead to obsessive behaviour and even conspiracy theory. This is something that Mark and I get into, and it's something that I found particularly fascinating. This is a really fun chat. We talked for a while about Mark's family, especially his grandfather, and also about what bliss and happiness means to him. We also talk about why he continues to work after getting the platinum parachute. And we talk a little bit about the treatment that he's getting with a psychiatrist and what preempted that treatment. Anyway, I found this conversation really fascinating, so I hope you do too. So here is Mark Burris. There is a Mark Burris myth. There is a, you know, sort of origin story, the punch bowl boy who came good. But you've been exposed in a family way to wealth. You didn't have access to it, but it did exist with your grandfather. Can you tell me a little bit about your grandfather?
On my dad's side, yeah. I didn't know my grandfather on my mother's side, my mother's side, because he died when I was very small. But my grandfather came to Australia in the 30s. So my father came to Australia in the late 40s with his brothers, but my grandfather was already here. He'd already been, him and his brothers left Greece trying to find somewhere better to go to during the Depression. And he went to Canada, got kicked out because he didn't have a passport. Those days, they didn't have passports. And he went to the USA. One of his brothers was able to stay in Canada. And then he went with another brother into Chicago. That brother was able to stay in Chicago. And then my grandfather wasn't able to stay in either. He ended up getting kicked out of Chicago as well and then ended up in Australia. And he brought his eldest son, Nick, over to Australia. Uncle Nick was significantly older than all the other boys, his brothers. And they started off a sandwich shop, and then they started up, and then they had a restaurant. We'll start off as a cafe, then a restaurant, and then they were leasing the premises. This is in George Street. And then he bought a house for himself in Maroubra, and he bought his older son a house, which is the tradition. All the other boys are still in Greece. Well, actually, they weren't even born. He used to go back to Greece every couple of years, and my grandmother would get pregnant. And then she just kept popping kids out left, right, and center. They lived in the bush in Greece and were in the countryside in Greece, and she lived there on her own with all these five sons. And but you know, they always had their neighbours in the village. But you know, it was affected by World War II significantly. Then it was affected by the Civil War significantly in Greece. But he was here in Australia building up assets, and he started off, bought the first floor, the second floor, ended up buying the whole building in George Street.
What building was it? Still exists?
The building, it does exist still, yeah. It's down the bottom of George Street, more down Haymarket area, where Haymarket is today. Yep. And today it's, I think, some Asian sort of restaurant in downstairs and a whole series of things upstairs. But the Chinatown then was a lot smaller. Hmm. And there used to be picture theatres across the road from it down there in those days. They used to, everybody who used to go to the restaurant, became quite a good restaurant. It's called the Jubilee Cafe, and that was, a well-known restaurant. But in those days, people used to go to restaurants after the movie, so you'd go there and have supper. And, you wear a collar and tie, and it was, quite swanky. And he had that and a couple of other sandwich shops, and but he owned the building and owned two houses, and they owned real estate, and valuable real estate at that. Probably where start-off wasn't that valuable in those days, but by the time I was born and my dad was married with the mum and living out in the west suburbs, he had plenty of money.
Yeah.
He was a wealthy guy.
Did you know him well?
I knew my grandmother better because she survived his death, and I lived with her for a while, just her. I knew him as a young man. Like, I was probably 12, 13 when he passed away, so I knew him as a teenager for a while, but he was a diabetic, a severe diabetic, and he was a big man, like a really big, tall, big guy, yeah. Blonde hair, blue eyes, but like to me, he was a giant. In that generation, to be 6'2", blonde hair and blue eyes, you weren't really Greek. But he was born in Greece, but like the general view is that their family, his side of the family, probably emigrated down from Bulgaria at some stage or around that territory, the Balkans, come in. My memory of him was he used to sit in a chair that he had in Maroubra, and because he was a diabetic, he couldn't walk properly, and, he had operations on his legs, and he used to have a cane, a walking stick, which is a cane, and he had no English. My grandmother didn't speak English either, but he would sit there and he'd wait for me to come within range, especially when I was younger than that, and he'd hook my leg and he'd say, hello, don Marco, which means come here, Mark. And I was scared of him because he'd hook me with this cane and he'd pull me into him and he was like a bear. He was so big and I felt like I couldn't escape. I'd never had a conversation with him, to be honest with you. He was very...
Did you speak Greek?
I knew I could speak enough Greek to, but not to have, I was too young
to
have a conversation with him, whether it was English or Greek. I understood a fair bit of Greek at that stage. I got better as I got older. But he was very quiet and old school Greek, like he was the boss of the family.
But he built this, sort of mini business empire without any English. How did he do that?
His son, Nick, spoke English.
Right.
So Nick came to Australia when he was very young, got educated here. Nick was in the army here, so he was conscripted. So Uncle Nick spoke good English. And then he brought all the other boys over.
Yeah.
And but also, those days they had there was a big community of Greeks here. So, he bought his vegetables from a Greek guy. He bought his meat from a Greek guy. He bought his bread from a Greek guy. Bought his coffee from a Greek guy. All his people from the same village lived around the corner from him. There was a big community of people he knew, Greeks, and they all had kids who were Uncle Nick's age, and they all got educated here and they all spoke English.
Yeah.
So that's how he got by. His kids spoke.
But he was in charge.
He was the patriarch of the family.
Yeah.
100%. And old school traditional too, unless you work in the family business, you don't get anything.
Yeah.
Unless you marry a Greek, you don't get anything.
Well, that was the situation with your family.
Yes. Yeah, that's what happened with my dad. So my dad married mum and she wasn't Greek, obviously. Not obviously, but she wasn't Greek. And that mum met dad in that restaurant, his father's restaurant. My mum was a waitress there, so that's how they met. But he just couldn't contemplate wanting to leave the business and go and work in a factory somewhere else. He just couldn't contemplate that.
Yeah.
And nor, why aren't you marrying a Greek woman? Like, what's wrong with you? So much so that they didn't go to dad's wedding. So, mum and dad's wedding. His father and mother did not turn up to the wedding. The eldest brother didn't go. And, in fact, the eldest brother told my father, I'm not going to win because you're not marrying a Greek girl. But all these other younger brothers, they all went. They snuck into the wedding. They all went to the wedding. Well, Dad's the second youngest, but the rest of them, they all came to the wedding. Unannounced, sort of thing.
Now the story of your grandfather, this story of, you know, him being a rural Greek guy who comes to Australia and builds this, you know, this kind of, in the context, incredible empire from nothing. Was that something that loomed large in your head when you were a boy, that you were like, you know...
Nah.
That did the money think anything? Nah. Did that mean anything to you?
No, the only thing it meant to me, the only thing I remember from that, to be honest with you, is that my father didn't get any of it when he passed away.
Yeah, right.
And that's only because I heard the conversation. I mean, I just thought it was unfair. Yeah. I just remember thinking fleetingly it was unfair. But I do remember the conversation that Dad never got any of that. He didn't get left in any of the will because he didn't marry a Greek girl and he didn't stay in the business. In some respects, it's sort of fair enough. He maybe didn't deserve to get anything from the sale of the family business and buildings and stuff because he didn't contribute to it.
How did he feel about it?
I never really spoke to my dad about it, but my dad's really so easygoing, yeah. And he just rolled with it. Like, he may have had some. He might have been. I don't think he would ever be bitter.
But you still have a great relationship with him. You were talking about being with him in the farm recently. Yeah,
yeah. You know, I'm always with Dad. Dad.
And yet, it's not something that he thinks.
It's not something he would have been bitter about. No, yeah. He's not that type of person. He doesn't have an ounce of bitterness in him about anything, or regrets. He would have probably thought, well, I wish it. He might have wished it hadn't been that way, but
it is what it is.
But it is what it is. I mean, and he was happy with his own decisions. He's very independent, like extraordinarily independent. Like when my dad was a kid, he's told me stories that he had an auntie. It's his dad's sister. When Dad was living in Greece, they lived on a farm. So they had a house in the village, and then the farm was outside the village. So my dad would take his younger brother, Arthur, Thanasis, he would take him when Dad didn't like this particular auntie. But when she came to stay, she wouldn't stay for a day. She'd stay for a month or something like that because she had to come from Athens to the village and because she lived in Athens. And Dad used to just take off. He'd go to the farm. He'd live on the farm, not a house. There was just like a makeshift thing. He'd
a lean-to.
He'd make a lean-to, yeah, with his younger brother. And like he was like 12 or 13. Mm. He lived there for 1 or 2 months on his own, catch pigeons, chooks, you know, eat vegetables, cook for his brother, younger brother. He'd just stay there the whole time. Like 11-year-old kid, 12-year-old kid, out effectively in the bush. It's pretty incredible. Like, and Dad's still the same today. Like he lives at home. Mum passed away a couple of years ago. So Dad's at home by himself. He's independent, can do everything in the house. There's nothing he can't do. Like he can make anything, build anything, fix anything, all self-taught. Still can climb up on the roof of the building, fix it. Still can paint the whole house, still cleans the whole house, still cooks for himself, does his washing.
How old is he?
86. He's like,
amazing.
He just does everything, everything.
Yeah.
He can walk anywhere. He can, you know, still do push-ups. He's as strong as a bull. His hands, his grip strength is ridiculous.
Olive oil. Olive oil's good for you, man.
Yeah, well, Dad's led a pretty clean life. He doesn't drink and, you know, he'll have a drink, but he's not a drinker sort of thing. He's led a pretty clean life. But I think he's got his genetics from his mum.
Yeah.
His mum lived till she was in her mid-80s too. So for her generation, that's a long time. So, and he lived a very clean, simple life in Greece as a boy. You know, never had ice cream, didn't eat red meat because there was no red meat there. You know, ate meat maybe once or twice a year.
Yeah. And his brain health is good? He's still...
Brain perfect. You think he can do everything. I mean, he's slowing down a bit, obviously, but he's in great shape. You know, I look back at that sort of program and even to this day, I mean, Dad lives in Mossman today. He's got a great house in Mossman, but, you know, because he just kept buying houses and doing them up and selling them and eventually landed in Mossman about 20-odd years ago. And but I look at how simple his life is. He does it really simple. Like there's no bullshit. There's no complications.
Is that what the farm is for you?
Totally. Yeah. The farm is 100% that.
Because you've got a farm up in northern New South Wales. What are you? You've got some trees there. You've got some cattle as well.
Yeah, I've got cattle. It's a stud. It's a Brahman stud.
Yeah.
But I have cattle. I have chooks. I have, you know, the vital stuff. The most important, I have olive trees.
Yeah,
I have...
Do you press your own olive oil?
Yeah, we do. We have olive oil and olives. We have olive trees. We have, you know, the essential fruits like lemons and limes and vegetables and, you know, lots of some exotic stuff, Aussie type stuff as well, Aussie fruits and you know, like kakadu plums and things like that. We try to grow those sorts of things.
But that's your attempt at the simple life. That's your attempt.
And so that is my simple life. Yeah. And like if I go there, I work harder there physically than I do here because I can't wait to get out and get my hands dirty and cut things down and plan things and fix things and... yeah, I just can't wait to do it. I couldn't go and just sit around. I mean, I've got all these fancy things there, like tennis courts and stuff like that, but like I never use them. I've never played a game of tennis there, ever, in 20-odd years. It's mostly for other people.
Did you buy a farm with a tennis court or you were like, I guess this is one of the things we should have?
I built a tennis court. There was nothing there when I went there. It was just a little shed there on property. It was a dairy farm when I bought it.
Yeah.
And dairies... up there when all went broke because Norco, the milk company, moved out of town and the dairy farms had nowhere to take their milk. So I bought it, you know, a long, long time ago, early 2000, and you know, slowly but surely turned it to a stud, you know, fixed things, built a house there, built other things. Mostly I built things there for my kids to use, but they don't use it that much either, to be honest with you. But, yeah, it's for me, it's sort of re-established myself, earthing myself, you know. It's a pretty chilled sort of a joint. It's not a fancy house. I mean, I got a timber house. Nothing fancy. I mean, fancy about it. It's nice.
It sounds like it'd be less enjoyable for you if it was fancy. I can imagine you got a fancy house in Sydney. So
I don't want fancy. You know, I mean, in Sydney I've got a nice house on the water. My house is a really beautiful position, but it's again timber house. I love timber.
Yeah.
Timber and glass are two of my favourite materials for building with. But I don't drive fancy cars. I mean, I have them, but I don't drive them. I never, ever drive them. I have fancy cars. They just sit in a garage. I never drive them. I drive a Toyota Hilux most of the time.
Workhorse.
I have another car. I've got to deal with Lexus, so I drive a Lexus. But generally speaking, I'm in my Hilux.
Yeah.
Main reason is because I can put my dog in the back.
Yeah.
And I've got a section on the back of on the tray and put the dog in the back. And I can go and park anywhere with it. Doesn't matter if it gets scratched. Fucking never have to put petrol in it. It goes for, you know, it's diesel, but never have to put anything. And I have one of those on the farm as well.
You like to drive a Hilux. You like timber houses, and you wanted just a rural property where you can work with your hands. It sounds like you're inconveniently rich. It's something.
Well, it does. I'm not interested in. I mean, I was when I was younger. I was a bit more.
Well, I wanted to actually go back to the drive at the beginning because nobody becomes successful in the way that you're successful accidentally. it just doesn't happen. So there has to have been a plan, and at some point there must have been this catalyst, this drive. Do you remember where that sort of started?
Everyone says to me, "You must have been driven." And it's funny. I was thinking about it the other day. I thought, well, maybe I was driven, but I just didn't realise I was driven. Like, to me, it's just normal.
Yeah.
So,
but you're compulsive about everything, right?
Obsessive about everything.
Yeah.
And a little bit compulsive, but more obsessed with things. So maybe what appears to be, or maybe what people would describe as, oh, Mark's really driven, to me is not necessarily driven. So I don't sit around thinking, I've got to get to this point.
Yeah.
I need to make this amount of money, or I need to buy that car or that house. That to me is drive.
Mm.
Or I've got to build a successful business. That's not how I think. I think I'm doing something today and that's what I'm doing. No one's getting my fucking way.
Yeah, right. So business ended up becoming the thing, and because you have the obsession, then you're going to take it to the nth degree. You're going to do it
I keep building and building and layer on layer on layer on layer on layer until
like
it gets
to... Like a self-replicating robot.
It just gets to where it is in the end.
Yeah.
That's if that's driven, then I am driven. It's not... To me, that's not drive. I don't wake up in the morning and say, oh, great, I've got to get off... No, it's not how I operate.
The best way I can do the thing?
I've got today to do the following things.
Yeah.
And I know what it is before I, you know, leave my house, and that's what's in front of me.
Yeah.
And people will try to crowd me, and I was talking about this earlier, but, you know, I maintain my space. I purposefully go about pushing for my space in order for me to do what I want to do, which is why I like fighting so much, because fighting's about... Actually, fighting is about creating space or reducing the space to achieve what you want to achieve. So you want to hit someone with I'm a left-hander, so I want to hit someone with a big left. I will poke out with my right hand first, my jab, to create the space and the distance, and then I'll land a left on him. And don't get me wrong, I'm not no expert at it, but like that's
there
what
is
I
a
love.
Science to it.
It's there's a science to it. It's about space.
Yeah.
Sometimes someone's clubbing me, I'm going to close the space up, and so I'm going to get in close. I mean, I watched that fight with Mark Hunt the other day, Gallen, and when Gallen ever gave Mark space, Mark bashed him.
Yeah.
And as soon as Gallen worked out to close the space,
yeah.
the fight changed.
Yeah.
And that's I spoke to Mark about it, and he reckons Gallen's totally a tough guy. Like yeah. he really is tough. Like I know I respect Gallen, but I know I also think Gallen is bloody smart because Gallen had the wherewithal, even though he got hit on the chin a few times pretty hard by Mark Hunt of all people. He had the wherewithal to think to himself, either that or his corner, think to
I
himself,
get closer to this place.
Yeah, reduce the space.
Yeah.
And you know, and I'm good mates with Jeff Fenwick, and Jeff has been my trainer for years. And Jeff's always saying to me, always says to me, you won't get hurt as much
when you're close.
In close.
Yeah.
He said, if you want to stand your distance, you better make sure you're pretty fast and you're very accurate and you're super fit and you can move. Like you can move really good and really well. And that might be how you're training. But you know, as Tyson says, you know, great plan until you get punched in the nose. Yeah. And as soon as you get hit in the head, all your plans sort of disappear. You just, you know, you're operating on instinct. And so being used to being in close or reducing space is really important. So in business, they're the same thing. In what I do is the same thing. Everything in my life is about creating space. I get when I get up in the morning, I go to bed at night, I don't look at my phone to know, I'm not thinking about what I've got to do tomorrow morning. I don't look at my diary on purpose. I don't know what I'm doing on Monday or Tuesday next week. I get a message from my office that I look at first thing in the morning when I wake up. Just to see, okay, what I've got to take to work for clothes, you know, appropriately dressed.
Yep.
And how's my morning going to get mapped out? Like, I'm going to go to the gym, then have I got time to go to which place for breakfast? Do I have a space to have a break for myself before all that happens? Then how's my day going to roll by? So I create space from the night to the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And that space is for sleeping. I do that on purpose.
Like it's almost like a cleanse. It's almost like a purge.
Some people say it's structuring. I don't structure. I would like to take that out of the narrative and say I create spaces so that I can actually do the thing that I'm supposed to do during that period so that I can do the next thing I'm supposed to do.
It's interesting when you were talking about boxing and, you know, counterintuitively actually getting closer to the hardest punches.
Because everyone thinks you've got to stay away.
No. And that feels like instinctively that's the thing that you'd want to do. But it's actually the same with infantrymen in combat. You know, once a gunfight starts, you actually want to shorten the distance, especially when you've shot at someone, which your body would be telling you not to do, but your training has to overcome that. And like if he's fearful of moving backwards and you're moving forward, it's much more likely that you're gonna catch this player.
Well, it's like fight or flight, which is the stronger instinct on you? Because, you know, like sometimes it's better just to cut and run.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out of there. And sometimes in the boxing, you know, if you're getting clubbed a bit, you want to get out of there.
Yeah.
And if they're ascending over, like they're bigger or faster or they're just on a momentum, you can walk back as fast as you want, but they're walking forwards.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can only go so far. There's a rope there.
Well, it's also about the leverage. If you're moving backwards, then your punches aren't going to be as strong as
and
the
hard to punch,
moving
it's
forward.
It's very hard to punch going backwards. Yeah. Muhammad Ali can do it. Not many people can do it.
Yeah.
You can play around with it, but just, you're not going to do it. And in business, it's the same thing. You're going backwards, you can't punch.
Yeah.
Stop. Just stop. And space. And business, space. In my life, it's not just about business for me. It's about space in my life.
Yeah.
So I create spaces. I used to talk about compartmentalizing things. So I have a shit day at work. I get stressed out. Something's really bugging me or I can't solve something. Two ways to deal with that. One is to remember when you can't work out how, to remember why. I mean, why are you doing something? And that sort of redeems you a little bit and you can sort of sit in the sunlight a little bit about why, you know, your righteousness. I mean, like, why am I doing this business? What is my purpose? You know, why am I helping people? I worry about how I'm going to solve this problem down the track, but why is an important thing? And there are lots of people, you know, people who've written books about this who are stuck in Nazi concentration camps used to think about their purpose in life, you know, what's important to them, you know, God or whatever it is, that helped them get through how am I going to get out of here when you don't have a solution. And I think, you know, business people need to employ. That's one thing to employ. But there's another one I call compartmentalization. So get home, I come home.
You mean, sorry, just to go back, though, what we're doing, like what we're doing with our lives, not necessarily what we're doing with our businesses. Is that what you're talking about?
General, or business, either way. Yeah. They're interchangeable.
Yeah.
So
it's almost like a mission statement.
I'm home.
Yeah.
Well, I'm home because that's where I live. I mean, and we, you know, it's supposed to be our castle, et cetera, but like I'm home. My family's here, my dog might be there, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm just home. The whiskey bottle's there. It doesn't matter who's there, who's your companion. It doesn't really matter. I say compartment. Okay, put all that shit in a box. I'm talking symbolically.
Yeah, of course.
Close the box. Put the box in the shelf. That you can open that box tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
But there's no point in opening, leaving it open now. Just close the box, put it over there, and do now what you're doing now. And do it with, you know, like as much zeal as you want or as much passion as you want, if they're the words you like to use. Or just don't do it with anything, but just do it. Just watch television. Have a whiskey.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is very similar to something that a young bloke told me on the podcast last week, a guy called Matt Williams.
Matty, who, big tall Matty, the, was he a
the soldier?
No, I'm talking about made in a triathlon, okay.
No, this bloke was a soldier who went to Afghanistan and then he was diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumour. And we were talking about, you know, the preciousness of his life and his hours and his days and how he maximises that. And he says, oh, I just make sure whoever's in front of me, that's the person I'm talking to, that's the person I'm thinking about, that's the person who gets all of my attention in life. You know, the thing that I'm doing right now is the thing that I'm doing right now, and that's the most important thing.
That's very Buddhist.
Yeah.
It's the present. And by the way, not worry about what happened, what's going to happen. It's very Buddhist. I mean, I did a lot of reading on Buddhism and, you know, I met the Dalai Lama and he allowed me to ask him some questions.
What did you ask him?
You got to keep that stuff to yourself. he allowed me three questions, but he doesn't like you to talk, like he wants you to kill yourself. But, I've always been acutely interested in that living in the present, doing whatever it is I'm doing right now, whether I'm talking to you or I'm doing something else, which is why I like to be honest with you, is like why I like to do my speeches. But when I used to do them up on the stage, you know, I could have 20 people, I could have 2,000. I did one with 8,000 people.
Yeah.
Because I get quite nervous and I'm a very sort of shy guy. I'm not very good at social environments, but when I get up on the stage, I get into the I don't want to say the zone, but whatever.
No, it is.
I get into the character of what I'm doing right there, and then I get completely absorbed. I get so absorbed that, you know, if I'm going to speak for an hour, like I held a few seminar type things, or I had 5,000 people in Sydney at the Star Casino, and I was only supposed to speak for 1 hour. Everyone paid to come see me, listen to me. But I spoke for 3.5 hours
because
I didn't even know the time had gone by.
You got stuck in there.
Yeah, but I was enjoying it so much. For me, is one of the great experiences. What I don't like, though, is when I get off the stage and you've got to start meeting everybody, then I get a bit awkward. Yeah. I start to feel, and I also feel drained.
Yeah.
After I feel quite exhausted because I give it everything. It's all my energy up on the stage. I quite like it. Some people get scared of it. I get nervous when I go up there. But once I'm there, I don't know what happens. But I'm so absorbed in it.
That's exactly the way that people, and I'm sure Jeff has spoken to you about that, that's how they feel about the enjoyment of the fight.
It's
like, you know, just all this energy, all this kinetic energy, all this, you know, sort of frantic feeling, just it concentrates and concentrates and concentrates, and then you're in there and there's nothing. You're in the ring, that's all there is.
Yeah, you can't hear, you know, I've done it, you can't actually hear anything outside the ring.
Yeah.
People can be yelling and you don't hear it.
There was something I wanted to go back to. I use the word compulsion, you use the word obsession. it's something that, you know, we've only had dinner once, but when you sit down with you do get a sense that that's a big part of your personality, this sort of obsession. And you sort of, you know, I could imagine that you get stuck in these ruts. You know, there's things that you must learn about, you must master. And if you don't want me talking about that, that's fine. We can cut this out. But you gave me a lift, and you were telling me about this instance where you were looking at license plates. And you were looking at the numbers, and you were thinking, you couldn't stop thinking about there being a pattern, there being something that there was actually meaning there. Have there been instances in your life where you've had to sort of corral this obsession to realise that your brain isn't typical? You know, it's productive in a particularly high-functioning kind of way, but, you know, you could potentially get stuck in these sort of mental cul-de-sacs.
That one in particular, yeah. I mean, I don't mind talking about it. I got in a period there for about maybe 10 years or so, for a 10-year period, where I became obsessed with number plate patterns and trying to interpret what they were saying or what they could mean. And was there some sort of patternization in the way number plates are produced?
Right.
By whoever produces them, the RTA or whoever it is. And were they secretly trying to send messages to people who were driving behind them?
Right.
And what did they mean? I remember when it started. One morning, just driving to work, and I saw a number plate. I can't remember what it said now, but it made sense to me. Like, I thought, oh, that means something. It was, you know, numbers and letters, and somehow I read something into it. Then I tried it. Then the next day I did it, and I did it again, different car. Then I started doing it with every car, and it would become like a massive distraction for me. It actually became quite difficult for me to drive and concentrate on driving, because then I found myself not just looking at the car in front of me, but the car coming towards me, the car across the road, the bus, everything. And I could see these number plates everywhere, and I'd start thinking about them when I got out of the car, and it just wouldn't go away. I became obsessed.
Did you tell anyone about this?
Yeah, I went and saw a psychiatrist about it. I still have a thing for looking for patterns in things. Like, I'm looking at a wall behind you now, and I have been looking since I sat here about how it's designed. And I'm thinking, what is the patternization of it? Like, is there, you know, why have they set it up there? Is that space there, that distance, has that been calculated as equal to that space there, and it's not equal to that space over there? Or is it because I'm sitting on an angle I can't see properly? And it's bothering me a bit, a little bit. Not bothering me a lot, but bothering me a little bit. So I had to learn how to manage that stuff.
Just tell us, you know, whatever it is that you're willing to sort of share, the conversations that you had with the psychiatrist and what he thought it was all about.
He said it's people who do this are like, you know, on the spectrum of Asperger's.
Yeah.
It's a bit of an Asperger-y type of thing. And some people who know me think that I am a bit that way. He was reticent to diagnose me, because he said, if I say that about you, he said, you know, if I end up with a diagnosis, he said, you're going to believe that about yourself.
Yeah.
And he said, it could get worse. He said, so, and he says, nothing gained by saying it. He said, he just explained to me how people like me, some people like me, look for patterns all the time. It's probably why I can play the piano.
Yeah.
It's why I can read music. It's probably why I love mathematics.
Helped you with numbers, spreadsheets.
I love mathematics. Yeah. Like, not arithmetic, but mathematics. You know, and equations, and why things work, and why a certain algorithm is better than is more effective than another algorithm. So, you know, and it's part of my pastime. One of my pastimes is reading maths books and science books and physics books and articles about stuff like that. So I now feed that thing with stuff I read. And but I can manage it now. It got a little bit weird and crazy for me, to be honest with you. But
was your primary concern, why am I thinking about this? You know, rather than it.
No, I couldn't control it.
What's wrong with me?
I can't control it. I couldn't control it. And I didn't know, is this bad? Or I'm thinking, is this a sickness? Or
it's like, is this the beginning of something that's going to get worse?
Yeah, totally. Am I getting spoken to by the universe? Am I getting schizophrenia? Like, I mean, what the fuck? But it only happened if I was in my car.
Yeah.
No one played. So if I was born in Australia, I didn't do it. Just in my car.
Maybe because there's no other sensory input. You know, you're literally just in there looking through the windscreen. You know, it was like a movie, to be honest with you.
And it's not wasn't good to drive that way.
Yeah,
it's probably dangerous.
Could you always manage to disassociate between the conscious feeling, the understanding that no one's saying anything to you, that it is random. Were there any times where you were actually like, fuck, maybe I'm right and everyone else is wrong?
No, all the time.
Really? Even after you'd spoken to a psychiatrist?
I literally had thought that there is a programmed messaging thing going on with number plate issuance. And then I started to think to myself, well, let's say I live in Bondi, the Bondi Wallara area, for example. Are they issuing certain number plates for that area so that some cameras around the place could be looking at these and know that these are cars that come from that area?
Yeah,
like it was just weird shit. Like
yeah.
It was meaningless, but I was the conspiracy stuff was just out of control. My conspiracy theory and what were they watching my number plate?
Yeah,
and like I none of it's logical. It's all totally irrational.
Yeah.
Totally irrational. And it got more weird and more weird and more weird. Like today with data, like, you know, I love data in every form. Wherever I can get it, I consume it. Like, you know, all the stuff I do at Mentored, everything is all about data. And I love building businesses that are around data. I mean, Mentored's a data business. It is what it is, but to some people, it's also, for me, it's a data business.
Yeah.
I can easily get obsessed bad on data.
On a large data set.
Oh, fuck.
Have you read Moneyball?
No, I haven't. I don't read books, to be honest with you.
I
don't read other people's
just
books.
Just math books and physics
books.
Yeah,
I read things like that, yeah.
And yet you have three of your own.
Four now.
Yeah.
I don't read other people's books. I never have.
Yeah.
I did at school, but like I had to, but it's not something I choose to do. But I'm reading a book on time at the moment. So I'll read that sort of book,
yeah.
The concept of time.
Yeah. Mechanical books that just sort of explain
Or something I think is important to me.
Yeah.
You know, where did time start?
Yeah.
What is time? What is the concept of time? And how does time get, you know, we all know how time gets measured, but like why is it measured a certain way?
How it can be warped.
Yeah, and how does time operate, you know, in terms of space?
Yeah.
And how can time change? So, you know, it's what time 20,000 metres above us is a different time to the time directly below us.
Yeah.
But directly below that point. It's only minute, but it's different. So, I they're the sort of books I read. But I read them, to be honest with you, sometimes to distract myself from my main life. If something might be bothering me, that's when I tend to read those books.
Can you, you know, you're someone who wants everything to make sense, you know, and you're presented with all of the information.
I try to make sense out of it.
Yeah.
I accept that everything doesn't make sense.
Well, I was going to say, when things that are completely out of control, you know, traumas, a death, you know, marriage dissolution or whatever it is, are you capable of incorporating that into a story, into the story of your life, or does it get to the point where
I don't get emotional about it.
Really?
Never. I used to get worried about not being sad. Like when my mother died, I didn't cry.
Yeah.
But I feel the loss of my mother. Like she's a great friend. We're great mates and everything like that. But I feel the loss. But I didn't cry. And everyone else was crying around me. My brothers, everybody. But I felt bad that I thought, well, hang on, why are you crying? What's wrong with you?
Mm.
But I didn't feel that. I don't manage it. It's just.
It's how you are.
It's how I am. I don't feel. I only really have one strong emotion. It's anger, and I've had to learn how to control that.
When does it manifest itself?
Anger, it's the penultimate. So for me, so like I'll get frustrated.
But what angers you? What are the things that
stupidity? People don't understand me. Someone can't follow what I'm talking about. It's usually in relation to someone else.
Yeah.
It starts at frustration. Or like, how can someone not get that? Like, why don't they understand what I've done? Or
you're like, I've articulated this. It's here for you. How can you not pick it up?
Yeah, yeah. And then I'll, and then if they want to talk to me and it's not, and the questions that, for example, don't relate to what I've just said or have no sense to me, don't mean anything to me, I can get more frustrated, and then ultimately that ends up in anger. I get angry.
Yeah.
I know how to control that now. But or when I was younger, if I was out and someone do something that was aggravate, I could get aggravated very easily. I'm pretty happy sort of guy, but I could get aggravated very easy. So that's my big emotion, and yeah, one of the ones had to learn how to control. You know, after making plenty of mistakes, but I had to learn how to control it, and that's one reason I don't drink much, because I find my judgment around anger, in relation to my anger, it gets compromised, yeah, or just goes,
yeah,
if I'm drinking. Well, if I'm drinking, I can be the best fun, but I can be the biggest nightmare.
Yeah, yeah,
I can be either one or the other, and it doesn't take much for me to tip over to one. I mean,
and so you've chosen the juice is not worth the squeeze. You know,
it's not worth it. Yeah. I don't feel good about it myself. I mean, I feel guilty about shit I've done. And I think, I should have done that. Yeah. What's the ramifications of that, the consequences? But also know that I can, you know, I can be a daredevil. Like, I'll do like complete illogical things if I've had a certain amount to drink. You know, and I've injured myself. I climbed up on top of houses and fallen through roofs and fallen off balconies, you know, into...
That's a 25-year-old's game. You don't want to be doing that anymore.
Yeah, but just from drink. I wouldn't ordinarily would never do it.
Yeah.
You know, some say, you would climb in and have a look at that. And I'd say, you're joking.
Yeah.
But get me a few drinks. I'm suggesting it, you know.
Yeah. We're running out of time, and there were a couple of things that I wanted to ask you about, just because you have had... this unique situation in your life that sort of most people don't. So you had a business with Kerry Packer, this was Wizard Home Loans. It was a 50-50 equity thing, right?
Yep. Half each, yeah.
Yeah, and yet you put $25 million in each, and then
I put nothing in. He put $25 million.
Oh, right, because it was your business.
It was my business. Yeah. Right. Well, let's say it was worth $25 million. So I guess I did put $25 million when he put his $25 million.
Your value at that point So you had equity worth $25 million when he bought his $25 million in, and then the business boomed, and you know it sold for $500 million. So you had the opportunity to sort of do whatever you wanted to do, but what you wanted to do is to build another business to keep doing the thing that you were doing. Where is that compulsion? Is it because there wasn't anything else where you were like, this is the thing that if I get the opportunity to check out, I'll check out and just do that? Or is it because that's how you defined yourself? You defined yourself as somebody who ran these businesses and did these things well? You know, why at that point make the decision just to keep going?
There's a book called Neurocomic. It's written by a neuroscientist and illustrated by an illustrator. It's a very clever book. Mm. And I recommend people read it, but we'll look at it because it's illustrated. But they talk about something that we do, that we all create a story about ourselves. So our brain, plasticity of our brain works in such a way that we come up with a concept of who we are, then we build layers and layers and layers of that and a whole lot of neural pathways, and then that becomes our story, and then we start to live that life, and in living that life we further confirm in our own brain that that's who we are.
Yeah.
That's why criminals become career criminals. They build a story that I'm a criminal.
And I mean,
that's why I don't like jails, because a jail does all that does, it's never going to rehabilitate them, rarely, because they come out believing they're a criminal.
Yeah.
They might be scared to do the thing they used to do, but they still think they're a criminal, and they still think like a criminal and want to become a criminal, or antisocial is probably a better way to put it. Anti against what the majority want to do. So to answer your question, when I had sold the Wizard business and I kept on at GE, who owned it for a while there until the GFC hit, my story about myself was that I was a mortgage guy.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. And even though it was the middle of the GFC, you know, I set up a new mortgage business, which is, you know, not a smart thing to do during the GFC, but I did. And because I believed that about myself. And it's sort of like that, and my brain was geared and set around mortgages. I had to then, people talk about pivoting. I had to sort of, pivoting your brain is about actually using the plasticity in your brain to actually create another story about yourself.
Hmm.
So I sat down, I thought, well, what else can I do? And I created this business called Mentor. The podcast has started off that way, and it's now has become mentor.com.au. And what I effectively become is a publisher.
Hmm.
So One of the main reasons I did this was to see whether I could actually stay as the mortgage guy and train my brain to be something else. It was a bit of a social experiment for me, and it's not a thing it required money to do. It wasn't a money thing.
Was it because there was a bit of a disappointment in you that after you had this big checkout and you'd had this huge success that you're like, oh, I'm still a mortgage guy? Like nothing changed.
Well, I got motivated because I won't say who it was, but someone said to me that after the sale of the Wizard business from GE to one of my competitors, because GE borrowed out of all their financial assets here, well, most of them, particularly mortgages, someone said to me that I will never ever be able to do the Wizard thing again. It was a dare. I took it as a dare.
Yeah, right.
And that's a fuck you moment.
Yeah.
So
he was suggesting that luck was involved or the circumstances. Well, the circumstances are such
that you'll never be able to do that again. And that's a dare to me.
Yeah.
And I sat down and thought about it.
It wasn't James Packer, was it?
No, it wasn't. But I sat and thought about it and I thought, well, no, it wasn't because he actually invested in the Yellow Brick Road. So
yeah, right.
I sat and thought about it and I went through it logically. Even though it was in the middle of GFC, I thought, no, there is a way to do it. I don't do it the same way. The process is different, but you can have the same outcome over time, which is what I did. So I created Yellow Brick Road, and it was literally I created Yellow Brick Road the day after.
Yeah.
I set it up the day after. The day after. And it's a bit of an example of what I said about I'll do things for a dare. It's like I dare you. It's a challenge.
Yeah.
You can't do something.
I think I can.
Well, fuck off. I can because I know how to do it. Yeah. But I just got to sit and think it through. It's not a silly dare when I thought it through. That's why I started Yellow Brick. That's 100% the only reason I started it.
Mm.
Then when I'm into it, that's it. I'm just into it. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And then I got to a point where I thought, hang on, can I change who I think I am? Can I start doing something else, become a publisher? And a publisher who collects data, which is what Mentor is all about.
I'm going to let you go because I know you're on a tight schedule. But before you go, I just wanted to ask you about your bliss. You know, what are the moments in your life where you're like, oh, this is what it's all about. You know, this is what I do it for. This is what living is.
I don't really experience, to be honest, bliss, those emotions. It's just not something. I'm pretty much. My brother's funny. My brother turned 60 the other day, and I went to his birthday. I had to make a speech, and my brother's not the same as me. So, and in my speech, I said my brother is someone who enjoys everything to the ultimate. If he's having a beer, he's sitting there tasting it, loving it, and like talking about it and expressing about it and saying this is the best beer or whatever. Or if he's in work, he's like intense. He's like extraordinarily intense. But he will be totally on that, totally intense. He's a little bit like me, but not like me because he lives in a broader spectrum, like from one to the other. So he can be a real cranky bastard, like super cranky at work and super, super serious. But then when he's outside of work, literally, and he's having a drink, he's totally the opposite.
Mm.
He's the life of the party. I'm never that. I'm sitting right in the middle. So I don't want this to sound sad, but I've never really experienced so-called bliss, what most people would consider bliss. I'm pretty even tempered, right in the middle, other than anger, but I'm sit right in the middle. And even with anger now, I can control it. But I don't know whether I'm doing this because I try to control myself. I don't know. I'm too scared. Well, I'm too scared to be one or the other. I don't know. But
maybe it's your worry. You know?
So bliss is not a word that I have in my vocab personally for me. So, but what are the things that I enjoy? Okay. In that realm, it's going to sound a little bit silly, but I mean, I would love to sit somewhere and close my eyes and feel a warm breeze on my face. That to me is important. I like in the middle of the winter to leave my door open in my bedroom, and any fuckers out there think they're going to break in, I've got a big German Shepherd in the bedroom. But I love to feel the cold breeze on myself and put the doona up and warm up, but just still feel the cold breeze on my face.
Yeah.
I love to see the smile on some people's faces. There are some people whose smiles...
Is authentic,
but just gets me.
Yeah.
And that smile is really important to me. Really important to me. I like to walk with my dad. I just love walking with him. Not talking, just walking. There's something about just walking with my mom, man. There's a rhythm in the walk. It's there's something about the connection with just me and him walking. And we only started doing it when since mum passed away, because I just went there to keep him company because mum was on his own, and then started walking. And next, now I think it's one of the best things that I can do. I was supposed to do a radio interview last weekend, the weekend before, with Chris Smith on 2GB. And Chris is a good bloke. I like him a lot. And I was supposed to do the interview at 9 o'clock. I forgot the fucking interview. And then his team rang me and said, can you do it at 11? I said, yeah, no problem. I went to my dad's house, and because I go to my dad's every Saturday. I went there on Saturday, and my dad said to me when I got there about 10, he said, I was listening to 2GB. He said, you're going to do an interview today, are you? And I said, yeah, I am, yeah. He didn't know what time. And then three of my sons arrived at my dad's house with my grandson. So I got excited about that, and I forgot to do the interview with Chris Smith at 11 as I was leaving. My dad said, what time is your interview with Chris Smith? I said, fuck, it's 20 past 7, 20 minutes late. But eventually I did it at 12 o'clock with him. And Chris is great, but he understood it. And I actually explained, I said, dad's and what happened. I told him the whole story, so he was cool. But so they're the things that, they're moments of bliss for me. You know, like, I love going to the fights. It sounds ridiculous, but I like seeing...
Oh, the energy's great.
It's the best.
Yeah.
I just love walking in there and they give you an armband or something like that, or you get stamped, or you...
Oh, it's a human zoo as well, all the different types of people, all the expectations.
Yeah, it's g'day, so-and-so, and then over here you got the, you know, you got a minister over here, you got the leader of the opposition, Albanese, you go to fights, you're always sitting there, and then you might see, you know,
the a couple of
gangsters sitting there, you know, and it's cool. It's that sort of gets my blood going. Like, I get quite excited about it.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, I love to perform on the stage. Even though I love boxing. Like, I love it when I have a fight coming up. Like, I really enjoy, I like the physical stuff, but I just enjoy, I don't know, walking in the ring and, you know, touching gloves and listening to the referee and trying to work my way through it all. And
Mate, it does sound like you have some blisses in your life.
Maybe they are bliss, but I...
And your face lights up when you talk about
that stuff. Yeah, my face does light up because they're things that I enjoy, but they're simple things for me, you know. That's, I'm not someone who wants to go and jump out of an aeroplane or anything like that. That's, to me, that's what something would be doing, is chasing, like, something blissful or you know, sitting on their super yacht.
That's more people running away from something, I reckon.
Probably right.
Yeah.
But I'm not a super yacht guy, you know. I actually love my farm. Like, it's... To me, it's one of the best things in my life. I'm lucky. It's a dream for me, and the farm is one of the best things I can do.
All right, mate. We're going to have to wrap up because you have to go, but thank you so much. You're a fascinating bloke.
Thanks, champion.
Cheers, mate.
That was Mark Burris. If you want to hear more from Mark, you can listen to him regularly on his podcast, The Mentor, with Mark Burris, where he talks to some of Australia's most notable business leaders. Or you could check out one of his books, and might I suggest his latest book, Rise, How You Can Succeed in Business, in Your Career, and in Your Life. Now, while you're buying books, I would like to suggest a book I wrote with next week's guest. The book is Born to Fight, and the guest is another Mark, Mark Hunt. Now, Mark is a very good friend. He's also a legendary UFC, Pride, and K1 fighter, and someone who has overcome one of the most horrific childhoods I've ever heard of. I've gone through a real journey with Mark in my life, working on his book, and the journey continues for him, and that's something that we talk about in the podcast. I love Mark. He's someone I respect a great deal, so I hope you download next week's episode. Anyway, this episode was recorded at Acast Studios in Sydney, and if you want to keep up with me and the show, go to my Instagram at Benny Mook, BennyMck, or on Facebook, Ben McKelvey Writer, and otherwise, follow your bliss.
What if the writer is attempting to create a story where nothing much happens, where people don't change? More reflection of the real world.
Nothing happens in the world? Are you out of your fucking mind?
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.